You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are. Is it by your fault? I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all.
So we slide into the second hour on the day after Christmas. Joining me is Tim Lynch. Tim, Merry Christmas. How are you?
I'm doing just fine, Mac. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Wow, you sound like you're next door. I love that.
Oh, yeah, we've got this sound thing straightened out, I do believe.
Wow. Yeah, the last time we did it both, like, Tim sounded like he was in the same room, and so did Jeff, so it was awesome. So it was awesome. So conquering technology, I love that. How was Christmas? Did you spend it just you and yours, or did yours and your kids get back? Because I know they're in Australia. So what'd you do?
Yeah, I was just a quiet Christmas with my wife and I and Max the attack Yorkie. I talked to the kids, of course, but as you said, they're in Australia, little bastards, and so I didn't have them around.
But yeah, Christmas isn't it weird? I mean, as you get older, and you go through what all parents go through, is it used to be this holiday with all this fanfare and craziness and presents, and then all of a sudden it's crickets.
hey, before I was remarried, Christmas and Thanksgiving were something to be endured. I hated them. It was right. It's not an easy time when you're alone and isolated. And so I'm just like I said at Thanksgiving, I'm just so thankful to be where I am right now, even though I'm not in Australia. that will come in due time.
No, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, I said, earlier in the week, hey, be mindful of the people that you know that don't, you know, that don't have a place to go, whose lives aren't great, because, yeah. And make sure you reach out to them. Make sure you reach out to them, because that's what's important.
And it takes reaching out, because I remember years ago you and I talked about this on this show. But when I was up on the coast of Oregon, where I knew nobody, I just happened to have a house up there that I didn't even know I had. But at any rate, all that crap aside, it was very, very tough to get through Christmas and Thanksgiving Day. And I used to go walk 20-25 miles. I mean, I had nothing else to do,
right.
And it just accentuates the predicament you're in. So it's very, very tough. Because I was not. The reason I mentioned all that is there was not a chance in hell I was going to call you or anybody else I knew and confess my predicament. I was, and that was wrong. I have learned the error in my ways, and I probably could have had a much graceful reentry had I reached out to some friends who I knew would have helped. But I was embarrassed.
You know, one thing that's interesting about that, Timmy, is I had Sergeant Parker on. We don't use his real full name, but and he was talking about, I mean, this is his first Christmas since his dad committed suicide last March.
Right.
And, in fact, his dad's birthday is tomorrow, to make it even the cherry on top, right? And he doesn't really speak about his mother, so I don't know where she is. But so he's alone.
Yeah.
First time, you know, it's ever happened to him. I said, what do you do? You know, he said, well, you know, when it gets hard, he said, you know what I've learned to do is I pick up the phone and I call my friends. I don't.
Smart guy.
Yeah. He said, I don't isolate myself. And I said, you know what? I said, that's such a grown-up thing. And he started laughing. He said, well, I'm not grown up, but I've learned it. And he said, and your class was part of it about isolation is the facing movement to the door of destructive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I have that in my head. So when I do feel shitty, I'll pick up the phone and I'll call my friends and say, hey, man, you want to hang out? He said, it doesn't matter if we watch a game or play video games or go get something to eat. He said, it always makes me feel better. Always. He said, and just getting through the next couple weeks, you know, he said, it's going to be different for me. And he said, I really appreciate you reaching out to me and whatnot. But, yeah, the holidays are tough, man. The holidays are tough. And if you don't know, and again, I believe, the more I do post-traumatic winning, we have a natural inclination to say one thing. How you doing? Oh, I'm good. Right?
Absolutely. Right? Yeah, that's exactly what I would have said if you called me back then.
Right. Absolutely. Nobody wants to be that guy or that girl and be the one who's hurting and the one who's fucked up during the holidays and all the rest of that stuff. Nobody wants to be that person. And so that's the beginning of faking it. And mm-hmm. we do it not just during the holidays, throughout the year. We do it 365. And if you'll stop doing that, and not with everybody, but with your close friends, right? And right. say, hey, man, I'm struggling. Can I, got a minute? And what would every one of your friends say?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Fuck yeah, I got a minute. What's going on? Ah, you know, I'm just sitting here by myself today, and I'm hating life, and I just want to reach out and say, hey, what's up, man? And, you know, and so it doesn't sound like that big of a deal. It is a huge deal, though. And hearing him say that the other day, and then my other guy, one of my other guys, I have a whole bevy now of sons.
That's cool.
Of sons that, I mean, they've either grown up without a father or they've lost their father in some way, shape, or form, that I consider myself their honorary dad. And I check up, I yoke their asses up, and I do that. And so I was talking to Matt Tyker, right, who's the Marine I met a year ago. Mm-hmm. And he, the one who was leaving post-traumatic winning, and the audiovisual guy came, and Matt has completely turned his life around. And so he was talking to me, and he said almost, not something identical, but very close to what Parker said, and he said this. He said, you know, years ago, like when I was hurting, and he said, and I was the other day. So Matt got out of the Marine Corps. He went on terminal leave, I want to say on the 20th,
mm-hmm.
on that Friday. So he saw Dave Furness at the package store, not the package store, at the store at the gas station. He was getting gas, and he was going to go over and see if General Furness was available so he could introduce him to his mom before he left. And he runs into him at the gas station.
Uh-huh.
He said, he was buying ice. And I said, yeah, even generals need ice. And so so he was talking about it. He said, you know, I got home, and he said, for whatever reason, I just went into a little bit of a kind of a nosedive, and I was feeling it. And my cousin, one of my cousins sees me and goes, hey, man, how's it going? He said, are you all right? And he said, I looked at him, and he said, no, I'm not all right. I'm not having a good day today. And I told him why. And he said, come here, man. He said, let me give you a hug. And he said, he gave me a hug, and it changed my whole day.
And yeah, I don't doubt it. I don't doubt that for a second. That's awesome.
And so what's cool is you're seeing people learn it.
And to include myself, like I said, I would have never reached out. The thought never occurred to me, although when I suddenly found myself in a situation, I stopped drinking. I stopped all that stuff and I was the most sober, put together homeless dude you ever saw. I was a great homeless guy. and that was what I had. That's the only thing I had to hold on to was my pride. Cause I'm like, well, I know where this is going and I'm not going there. You know, just thank God I don't have that gene that makes alcohol that attractive to me. Cause I don't. And I'm glad cause that was a bad time. It just was.
But it's amazing how the steps to get out of there aren't as complicated. The biggest thing you have to overcome is your own pride.
That's exactly right. A friend of mine from Corpus Christi, I was going to walk across the country because I didn't want to tell anybody I was homeless. I was trying to find a reason to walk across the country because I thought it'd be cool. And a friend of mine in Texas, in Corpus Christi, found me a menial job but with a place to stay. And I started, and it didn't take me long after that to get to find a better job and get back on my feet. That meant less than 6 months. But if he had done that, I don't know what I would have done because I had very limited options. You know?
It's amazing, though, the whole pride thing.
Mm-hmm. Right? It is.
Stupid. Yeah, no, but I mean, again, we're biased towards it. You don't want to be that person, and then you start to fake it, and that takes you down this road of faking it. And then pride gets involved. Well, what are they going to think of me? And the answer is nothing. All they'll do is help you. Because that's what friends do. And those are the kind of friends that we have, certainly. And so pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. The but holidays are different, right? Holidays are different. Now, I'm lucky in that ours are all going to, they're flying out today. So we're going to get everybody together here for the next few days, starting tonight. And be together for, I don't know, 4 days.
That would be great, man. Yeah. That's good.
Which is as good as it gets when your kids get when you get older and your kids get older.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, it is. It is. I enjoy being around my kids now that they're adults, but I just don't get the opportunity much anymore, which is my fault. I should have never taken them to Afghanistan and gave them a travel bug.
There you go.
It was a mistake, yeah.
You know, one of my uncles said that. Don't let your kids travel.
Yeah.
Because all they're gonna do is leave.
Oh yeah, when they found out how easy it was and how fun it was, that's how they ended up in Australia. But anyway. What can you do? Love them to death, but I will be one of these years. They will all be here, and I'll have a weekend like you're about to have, and I'll be a happy, happy man. Although I'm pretty happy right now.
Here's an email. Did Tim just say he was homeless?
I did.
Explain to everybody.
I did. 2012. I came back for good from Afghanistan, and I was not doing well. I was drinking then, that's for damn sure. And my marriage had already fallen apart. The ex was gone. I came back to an empty house in Yelm, only to discover I had another empty house in Oregon, bought with a power of attorney, which I foolishly signed. And so I was. I had the ex had cleaned out the bank account. I had limited funds. I wasn't really too sure what I was going to do in divorce court. Her lawyer was successfully able to portray me as a crazed killer contractor in Afghanistan, based on I don't even know what. And so the judge took a very dim view. My point was, listen, I'm a reconstruction specialist. I haven't never shot anybody. And quite frankly, I had money set aside that the ex was cleaned out here for. And my defense was dismissed out of hand. The woman hit me with $250,000 worth of fines and stuff like that, which forced me into a no-asset bankruptcy. And after the no-asset bankruptcy, I had no assets and I was bankrupt. I was living on half my retirement pay, and which you can do pretty successfully when you're a bum. $1,400 a month every month for a bum, if you stretch it out, you can live relatively comfortably. But I was in coastal Oregon. I knew nobody. I mean, I knew more people in Kabul than in any city in America.
How did you wind up? How did you wind up there? She was
my ex had bought a house there. I did not know. It was a nice house. It was right on a lake that was right off the ocean. It was cool. It was in coastal Oregon, which is a fun place to be about 2 months out of the year. You know, the rest of the time, it's empty. The economy's trashed in Oregon. And so it was no opportunity to find any kind of productive work. And I started walking. I figured out that the best way to get out of my miserable situation was to put myself in a more miserable situation where all I'm thinking about is dry feet and how am I going to get something warm to eat today. And that, when you reduce your problem set to stuff that you would think about if you were in the field for a lot of time, you know, all of a sudden things get much more manageable. And like I said, I'm a reader. You know, I was always reading. I always had a book with me. I'm rather articulate, so amongst the homeless set, I was quite popular because I would explain things to them that others didn't seem to grasp. But yeah, I was homeless, bigger than shit. It was most embarrassing.
The How do you turn that around in your life?
A friend of mine called a doctor, Keith Rose, who I had known in Afghanistan. I had actually gone and fetched kids out of the mountains there for. He was a plastic surgeon. He does the reconstruction for the cleft palates. That's his specialty.
Is he a Shriner guy?
No, not a Shriner guy. He's a Christian guy. It's another faith-based guy. It's not Shriners, but it's more of a Christian-based thing.
Because that's what they do. That's what they do, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Shriners aren't the doctors. The Shriners raise the money to get the kids operated on and take care of them afterwards. This is just one of the. There's a lot of them. I ran into probably six or seven from various countries who come over, donate their time at these hospitals. Their flights being paid for by Christian relief organizations. And he actually had called me and asked me how I was doing. I said, oh, I'm doing fine. And he knew better. And so he found a job. He found a job with a place for me to stay. It was at I was working on a dock loading vegetables and fruits on the trucks to deliver this. It was a produce delivery service. Miserable work because it was working for a kind of a miserable person.
Right.
But after I was there for a while, Jim Lago, who was a morning drive-by host, I used to go on his show a lot. Jim Lago is a Vietnam vet, and he took a shine into me. We're close. And he found me that Ainsworth trucking job, and they had no idea what to do with me. And I told the owner, David Ainsworth, I said, I can do any job you have here except for drive a truck, because I don't want to do that. And I became, after rotating through every area, I became the safety manager. And in a year, we drove down to safety instance. We got the number one safety record in Texas for truckers the year I was there, mostly due to Dan Goodrich, the other guy I was working with, who's really good at this stuff. But I did real well. I got a car. I started dating. I got a nice place to stay that was more than I should have paid, but it was on the water. And I ultimately met my wife and got back on a trajectory that would be more acceptable in polite conversation than being a bum.
Interesting. The as you look back on that, what did you learn?
There were times I should have made decisions within that relationship that were hard to make that I should have faced up to. There were things I let go and didn't tend to, and all of that came to bite me in the ass. Thinking that it was a good idea to give her access to all the money I was making was a ludicrous thing to do, and I knew better. Second marriages is a tough. This was a very attractive younger woman, no doubt, but not that altogether mental faculties were lacking. And so what I learned was the first thing is to be very proactive, and the second thing is, quite frankly, to reach out to people, because trying to do this on your own. I kind of did it on my own because I made the decision not to drink, which was actually the Oregon State Police helped me with that decision, because for a year I couldn't drive my car unless I had one of those things to blow into start it. I couldn't afford that, so I parked my truck. I befriended another homeless dude and he would drive me around. But it was just plain, flat-out difficult, and what it took was me accepting responsibility for all the decisions I had made that got me there. That was the only person to point it. I could sit there and put my finger at other circumstances and other things that are inherently unfair, but that doesn't matter. In the end of the day, I was there because of the decisions I made, and I had to make the decisions to get myself out, and I would have been faster had I called you or anybody. I mean, the only reason that Keith Rose call me was one of my daughters had ratted me out. So I didn't like that phone call either, you know.
She ratted you out to him?
Yeah. My kids were kind of frantic about this walking across the country stuff. It's a dangerous thing to do, quite frankly. A lot of people get smacked on the highways. And for months I had planned this out. I had a cart made up and I could figure out where I could haul water. It gave me a mission and something to do, but it was a bullshit mission. And right before I was supposed to set off, I got a call and he said, this is crazy and you need to come down here. Which was good, because I'd been overseas almost continuously for 8 years. It isn't like the military when you're contracted. Nobody gives a crap about physicals or shots or stuff like that. That's irrelevant. I had a physical, and I came down. The first thing he did was finger stick me, and my glucose was 400. He goes, "You're sick and diabetic." I'm like, what?
What?
I was.
Yeah.
So obviously, had I launched across the country, I don't think that would have ended well for me, because I had some medical issues that I had to address, and that took time.
Give me one other thing you've learned.
I don't like saying this because it sounds contradicting what we're talking about, but the one thing I learned is that I'm not an asshole. And I can,
what? Are you sure?
I can be at the very bottom, and I can say, you know what? I did this. I'm going to get myself out. Being pigheaded like that is not the way to go. But I'm very proud of myself for having done that, for realizing that that I was just one step away from becoming a no-shit bum, not an articulate, kind of clean, a funny-to-be-around bum. And I'm proud of that. I learned that I had inside me what it takes to overcome adversity, even when you've generated it yourself by being a dumbass. And I thought that was worth knowing. I think everybody that you talk to, these Marines and whatnot, I think that they probably sense and feel that too. Because at one point they stopped. I never got to the drinking a bottle of Jack Daniels stage, mainly because I couldn't imagine that. I just don't like it. But I know that inside me I have what it takes to climb out. You know, throw me at the very bottom, and I can climb out. And I'm proud of that.
Yeah, and then you just got to stop the part where we climb back in, right?
Exactly.
That's always the caveat to that. It's like when you hear people say that, and you're not the first person I've ever heard say that. I showed myself, you know, that I can pull myself out of there. And then the admonition is, okay, genius, now let's try not to climb back in that son of a bitch. Right?
And the way you climb back in is by isolating yourself. I would submit to you.
You know what? You know, Tim, I mean, that's exactly it. And I've heard other people in my life say that, you know, what you said, it's like every decision that I made in my life took me there. And there was nobody else that did that except me. But until you accept that, and sometimes that's hard because you've had maybe other people in your life telling you that shit for a lot of it. And maybe not you, but a lot of people do, because these things are the things that divide families. These things are some of the things that end friendships because somebody's being pigheaded. And the people that love them and care about them have watched this journey and can't do it anymore. And then they kind of put you at arm's length. And then when that happens, that pisses the other person off. You're not fair to me. You judged me. You did this. No, I just can't have you fucking my life up anymore, man. Right? And so there's a lot of pain, a lot of baggage that goes through that. And so that's not always the easiest step to take.
Mm-mm. No, it certainly wasn't. But, you know, like I said, it's something I can be proud of, but then at the same time, there's lots of things that I accumulated along the way that I lost, that I don't have anymore. I remember listening to you talk about finding a book that you had as a kid that you pulled it down and whatnot. And I was like working out, listening to you. This is a couple of years ago, listening to you. And I just got upset. You know, I don't have any of those things anymore. I only have what I could carry on my back. And, you know, anyway. That's one of those things, you know, that life ain't easy, and it sure feels to me like it's getting easier now. Maybe it's the age thing. I don't know.
No, I think it's smarter because, I mean, look, you can not the only thing that stops you from going down that road is you,
right?
And that is, and then the support of others. That's what stops you, anybody, from going down that road, because that road is accessible 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can get on that motherfucker anytime you want to.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And to me, the self pity route is the devil's handiwork. And so that was how it started. I refused the self pity thing, and then I started through reading. I started gathering the I started reading a lot of books about the topic and became rather knowledgeable. You know, this is my story, of course. I've got random trivia and all kinds of topics. I'm an expert in nothing, but I can throw out some trivia and a lot of things. But it was a slow and painful thing to do, and I'm glad that I did it out of sight of anybody that knew me. But it was or knew me well. But it's not like I said. It's hard. It's hard to say now.
Well, it's almost it's almost like you live two lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
The one you live in front of everybody, and then another one that you'll live. When nobody's looking.
Right.
And then the important thing about living those two lives is to make sure you keep them separated, because you don't want at any point, right, those lives to cross and the curtain to get pulled back on the charade that mm-hmm. you're running. And so to me, and again, that goes back to the faking it part. And you could talk about different aspects of your life. But most of us, right, do what Tim's talking about. I mean, maybe we don't go down the road Tim went down, but most of us, right, most of us fake it. And that's what I loved about these conversations that I've had with these young guys that have come to post-traumatic winning, and it spoke to them. It spoke to them. And when they hear, don't fake it anymore, their response is, hell yeah. You know, and that's when I get that one of the things I love when people say to me, and that is this, it felt like you were talking straight to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and you've got, and I remember you saying that Dave Furness had talked about his daughter in introducing you, and I was floored by that. I've never heard of a general officer talking about that kind of insider information, revealing those kind of things. And it was amazing to me, but... It shouldn't surprise me. I know Dave, so you know.
Well, and that's where
that one out.
Yeah, when the moment that happened, if you can imagine me sitting against the wall and knowing him like you know him, and knowing that he never talked about this in front of strangers,
never, no,
ever, and wouldn't. He doesn't talk about it in front of his friends.
No, he's never told me about it.
And so. So I sat there and just watching him and thought, this is the kind of dudes that our friends are, right? That after hearing me say, you know, you got to talk about your shit, right? And he stood up and did it.
Yeah.
And I will tell you this, one of the reasons that Second Marine Division has made, I think, such progress is his personal leadership and his personal example, because he goes to everyone that he's seen it 23 times, and he introduces every time, and he closes it every time, and it's as pointed when he closes it, right, as when he opens it. And so to me, if I've done it where I did it for the first time and I've changed the my pre-event correspondence with organizations because of it, where the commander, the executive officer, the sergeant major, or the OPSO, none of them showed up to introduce it. It was just like, oh, we're bringing you in here to talk.
Oh, yeah.
And it doesn't land with – what I do is it's powerful, right? But
right.
It's more powerful, and it's better internalized when one of those significant leaders of the organization stand up and play Dave Furness. And so I changed when I correspond with organizations before I do it. I tell them, look, right, if nobody that leads your organization will come do this, then I'm not interested in coming.
That's a good policy. That's smart.
But it is. It's part of it is standing up and telling the truth, which is not easy to do about any of our lives, especially where it goes to, you know, the parts that we're not comfortable with ourselves, you know. And so if we're not comfortable with ourselves, we sure as hell aren't sharing them with anybody. But, again, the road to a better place goes through that function. And if you won't do that, then you're going to stay in that divided world, and you're going to stay in that fucked up place. And that's why I think it's so important that adults like us stand up and say this kind of stuff to young people. And people that have real world experiences and things like that, and they look at us and go, wow, you know, these guys are legit, and what they say is pretty direct, and it resonates with me. And I think that's really important, because it does not sound the same from a therapist or from somebody else who speaks to you in very measured, you know, polite tones.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sound the same as, hey, I'm going to tell you the truth today about what it is to live with trauma, and if you don't like it, I don't give a fuck. It does not sound like that.
Yeah, and but having somebody from the leadership introduce the topic to show it, to give it some weight and whatnot, that has to be. I can see that as why it's a mandatory, because what Dave did was remarkable. I've never heard of a general doing that, ever.
Oh, no.
And I was so impressed.
Well, and let me tell you, and since he did it and others saw it, I mean, most of the ones who get it, I mean, they come down. And, you know, General Mullen tells a story about his youngest brother drowning when he was a first lieutenant in Okinawa. He said, you know, this guy, he was a kid that was born 10 years after everybody else.
Huh.
I said, I have one of those. And he said, you know, I took that kid everywhere. And he said, I think he was more excited about me becoming a Marine officer than I was. He said, when I'd come home, right, he'd want me in my uniform all the time. And wherever we went someplace, he'd always ask me, will you wear your uniform? No, I don't want to wear that. Come on, please. And he said he wanted to show me off. He said, I came to pick him up from his school. He was hanging out my window screaming at his friends, you know, my brother's here and all of that. And he tells a story about when he died at the age of 11. He drowned. Heavy rains in Philadelphia. He and his friends playing down by a creek and or an irrigation drain or something, and he slips and falls in, goes into a culvert, and drowns at the age of 11.
That's horrible.
And he talks about it. He said, look, you still can't. I mean, like, you get choked up with emotion as you talk about some of the stuff you've gone through. I mean, you can't go to those places without getting emotional. And so he does that. He's done that the last two times at the Cornerstone course for all the regimental and battalion commanders in the Marine Corps and their sergeants, majors, and their spouses.
Mm-hmm.
And so General Mullen comes over, and he crushes it. He's awesome. And and he saw Dave do it. In fact, after I did that, I want to say Tuesday afternoon, I got a note from General Mullen, aide, saying the general would like to speak with you. And I said, really? And he said, well, look, I'm still in town, and I'm not leaving till Friday. If he would like to meet, I'd love to. So I went down to his place, to his office, and we sat and talked about, and this is before I'd ever given it, that was the second time I'd given it, was at the General Officer Symposium after I'd done it the first week at Camp Luzerne. And so, he saw, and like I said, he saw Dave do it, and he got it right away. He said, you started talking, and he said, it's like you were on my frequency the whole time. That's just cool. Let me read you another email. Mac, I'm sitting here once again with my jaw on the floor. I can't believe somebody who I've listened to on this show for I can't tell you how long all of a sudden comes out with a story like that. Unbelievable. Here's another one. This is from Nancy in Pennsylvania. It's entitled Tim. Thanks so much for telling your story, Tim. Bless you, Nancy in Pennsylvania. Now, Nancy's an inspiration. Nancy, you know, diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when she was a kid.
I know who Nancy is from listening to you.
Right. Yeah. And she's...
That's remarkable.
You know what I mean? And so, yeah. I don't know. And we're so afraid to tell the truth, right?
No, we are, you know, and I had mitigating circumstances that I could have laid this all on top of, but you know about it. If people go back into Afghanistan history and in 2009 start looking up the Afghan the Pentagon's private spy network, that's the story that I got to mess with. That I'm still paying. I'm still dealing with the IRS now on because of that. I mean, I got hosed, and I think what I was doing was absolutely right. But I really can't talk much about that because there's going to be a book coming out about it next year or two, and we'll see if I'm vindicated or not. I think I'm going to come out smelling like a rose, but I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. No, it is. It is interesting. That something that is so hard for us is so ultimately empowering and life changing, right? Mm-hmm. To me, that I find this kind of dichotomy between something that we're so afraid of and that intimidates us, yet is so empowering in life. And it's so cool to watch somebody do it because, I mean, I always tell everybody, look, I've told my story, you know, of in front of probably close to now 40,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and everybody knows how many assholes there are in the Marine Corps, right? And mm-hmm. everybody starts laughing, right? And I always say, how many emails do you think I've received that have told me what a clown I was, what an embarrassment that I was with my woe is me story, which it isn't, right? But, mm-hmm. I mean, you could see how somebody would write you that email and bust that off on you.
Right.
And they look at me and they're like, how many? And I say, zero. I've never, ever received an email like that. And I said, so the thing that I've learned is that people respect the truth. Right? They respect your honesty. And even people that might be inclined to do that have never, ever, ever done that to me. And they're like, wow. My point is, so don't be afraid of it. It is intimidating, no doubt, to be honest, especially about the things that we all find, less than pleasant about our own lives. But, you know, my experience is this. If you'll share the truth, right, and you won't be afraid of it, it will have a profound impact on your life. And the other thing I'll tell you is this, just about everybody else is faking it too, okay? About everybody else is faking it too. And for them, as I say, the truth is enabling to them because you're telling them it's okay to tell their story as well.
Mm. No, that's profound. And the other thing about your presentation, brother, is you're not trying to sell anybody anything.
Right.
You've just I had problems saying that word, synthesized a bunch of material and are presenting the old Marine's words back to them. You're doing nothing but passing on good gouge, essentially. It's just a miracle to me how you were able to synthesize that all together and get into a coherent presentation, but you're not selling shit, and that's the other thing that I like about this post-traumatic warning. We're not trying to sell you nothing. We're just telling this is what it is, and this is what you can do. Take it or leave it. I like that approach.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, it's the unmistakable truth that again, everybody that has come on this program, and again, it ranges from Cal Humphrey, who is 91 years old when he came on this program to talk about mm-hmm. his time on Iwo Jima and then what it was like to come home. And that although he supported the VFW and the Legion, he never went into those places because he didn't want to hear those stories. He didn't want to go back there. And mm-hmm. and he had stayed in contact with some of his Marine friends. And, and he even said, I asked him, I said, well, doing this, you know, cause you to think about it, what'll cause you, you know, duress? And he said a little bit. He said, but you know, I don't lay in bed and think about it anymore. You know, when that happens to me, and again, the wisdom of ages, right? He said, mm-hmm. I get up and I read, till I fall asleep. And he said, I've learned, you know, I've learned I have my own little way of doing it. And then after a few days, he said, I'll be okay again. He said, but, yeah, you can't let this stuff out without it, you know, without it taking its toll on you. And which I thought was profound. And again, but again, from him to Matt Kiker and everybody in between, that has, it is simply the truth. Now, I'm not a PhD. I acknowledge that. Right? I'm not a therapist, although I do play one on the radio sometimes. but I've lived it, right? I know what works, right? And I know what the limitations of this are. And the limitations start with, if you have structural mental health issues, right, you're going to have to solve those before you get to this. Okay?
Yeah.
I can't. Yeah. That's beyond what post-traumatic winning does. And it's easy to say that. But I would tell you this, the crisis of mental health in this country isn't a crisis of depression, schizophrenia, bipolar. It's a question, it's because people that don't have classic mental health illness are struggling to cope with life when it becomes overwhelming. Because they've been raised now in a culture, young people, especially not old people like us, but young people have been sold a bill of goods as bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
They've been sold a false narrative about what awaits them. People that care about your feelings, they're not out there. Institutions that care about your feelings and how hard you tried, they're not out there either. They are for-profit businesses that are hiring you. They are people that have loaned money to you for a house and a car, and they will come repossess it if you don't pay your shit. So they've been sold this false narrative, and then they go out into the real world, and when it rolls on them, what do I do? What happens? Now what?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have the coping skills because they're waiting for somebody to come and say, oh, come here, pumpkin. Did you try hard? Well, that's okay. Nobody's coming that's going to say that.
No, not at all.
I can help. We can help all those people by telling them the truth and challenging them to be better.
No, there's absolutely no question about that. And something else that I was thinking about as you were mentioning it, I adopted kind of like it's sort of a meditation technique. I'm not good at meditating, right? But what I'll do is when I feel myself cycling down, because I always do during the holidays, it's just stressful for me. I just have bad memories. What I do is I'll sit calmly and start thinking, and of course, you know, you're trying to make your brain shut up, and it starts popping up with all these things, and whatever it's popping off on, I start addressing, which is why I sent you that email earlier in the week, because I wasn't sleeping. And my sleep hygiene is pretty damn impeccable, you know, as far as going to bed on time, never drinking, I mean, all that stuff. And so when I find myself, you know, after 4 hours I'm wide awake, I just start clearing everything that's in my mind that I've got to address. I start addressing those things, and it's a very effective technique for me, because what you're trying to do is to get your damn head to shut up, put the monkeys back in the cage and behave yourselves, and that's just another technique I thought I'd share. Because that's why I sent you that email.
So you do what Cal Marvin does. You don't lay there in bed and think about it. You get up and you do something.
I'll make a list, and then I'll knock out that list. Hopefully I'll go back to sleep. I'll knock out that list the next day. When I sent you that email, I was writing that at 3:30 in the morning because I knew I wasn't going to get back to sleep, and I wanted to get that one topic off my chest.
I know. I was like, what the hell?
Right? I was out of the blue.
But you know what? It's not like that's atypical for our friends.
No.
Right? It's not like you don't get those in the middle of the night from somebody on occasion. And you know what's going on. For whatever reason, they can't sleep, which is not abnormal for our friends.
No. Uh-uh. No, it's not. Sleep hygiene's a big deal. But I'm getting better. You know, all you can do is just keep on pressing on. And the one thing when I was in the VA the other day talking to my doctor about this, he goes, well, I've got some better pills. And I'm like, well, what good is that going to do me? So I get a couple of nights sleep off the pills. That's not exactly a solution, you know. But it's not like the VA has a solution for you either. The solution, in my opinion, is being involved in something like this right here and thinking about other people's problems, not your own. That's a gift if you can get in that kind of a situation.
No, you know what? It's hard though. You know, it's hard. You try to help people, and like I said, the biggest, in my opinion, again, the biggest impediment is pride. The biggest impediment is pride, and if you can overcome your pride, right? Then you can do something about this. But I'm not gonna lie, it's hard. You know, some people can't do it.
No, I know. Like I said, back in 2013, there was no way you would have heard from me. I was much too embarrassed to ever even think of that. If my kid hadn't ratted me out, God only knows where I'd be today. But
yeah,
I was lucky.
That's amazing. No, I mean, those are the hard things that you have to go through. But again, I think that's such a natural and easy road to go down. And the more people, when I see it happen, it's like, yeah, no kidding, you know, no kidding. Yeah. It's not hard to get there. It's an easy place to get to in life. Because it starts with, I don't want to be the one that's the needy one. So you thought you were going to go do your life and not need anybody, that you would be the strong one for other people, but nobody would ever... need to be strong for you. That's what you thought, right?
It's a stereotype, particularly for males. It's a stereotype of a lone gunslinger who comes in, sets everything straight, and when everything's straight, the population don't want him around because he's more of a wolf than a sheepdog, and off he rides into the sunset. Or the other way that we learn in Hollywood how to deal with this stuff is to sit and drink whiskey and brood, you know? And the one character is never going to happen, and the second way is a very easy way to slip into irrelevance and permanent depression. I mean, Jesus. So we were never given good role models on how to do this ever, and only now, as we're approaching 2020, have I ever found anything that makes sense to me, which is listening to you.
which
when we knew each other as captains is something I would have never thought of.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, but again, somebody wrote me an email not too long ago, and they said, please don't read this over the air, but one of the things I find most interesting about your show is you guys are the group that I would not suspect would be doing this, and it's so refreshing that you are. Because in my opinion, one of the things that makes your message so powerful is where your group comes from, and I think that's spot on.
No, it is. You know, the infantry officer community is a tight and competitive little bunch, and there's not a whole lot of incompetent people in that MOS field. You know, and in that field, we all had good reputations. We did really well. We loved it. And I think that certainly helps.
And I think that when you hear things that touch my heart, right? I go down to solve the audio problem at Jeff Kenney's house a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I are just sitting there shooting the shit. And Jeff is a smart, smart, smart dude.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Unbelievable memory. Good God.
Yeah, but I mean, he's like, for all his coarseness and crassness, right? He's got a brain and a half. He's got like two brains stuck into one head.
Oh, yeah.
And so he looked at me and he said, that's why this makes so much sense, what you're doing. And I was like thinking, holy shit, man, when Jeff Kenney says, you know, and it was something like, the more I think about this, and I was thinking about this relative to this, and that's why what you're doing makes so much. He said something like that. And I was sitting on the couch at his house, and I was fucking with his computer and headphones and a microphone and things like that. And I just, when I was driving home, I just remember thinking, wow, you know, the power of this when you have a guy like Jeff Kenney saying that. And again, he's about as stereotypical and is about as crusty as it gets in the Marine Corps.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, he is a legit dude. There's no doubt about that. Marines loved him. I mean, loved him.
Yeah.
When he was a company commander, it was so cool to see.
No, and I've had so many of his former Marines email me and say, hey, sir, I love when you have Colonel Kenny on. And he was, you know, I met him when he was a lieutenant, blah, blah, or I met him when he was a captain, or I crossed paths with him here or there. And they just, he's, you know, he's that combination of dudes.
Yeah.
Smart, and they always say, one of the smartest guys I've ever run across in my life. And so, but again, it's the power of helping people. It's the power of being real with them and saying, look, this is what I've gone through. This is what I've experienced. And look, you can, if you'll do these things, you can go to this place. And that's why, you know, whether it's your story, Tim, or any, you know, Jeff's story about, you know, about getting, you know, wounded and his struggle to come back as a human being, you know, after that, you know, your candor, right, encourages other people to go there. And that's the place where, you know, don't be afraid, right? Don't be afraid to be honest with people. Go there, because the path to a better place, right? The path to a better place is on that path. So,
yeah.
So anyway,
I remember something else about with Jeff. It just reminded me. He had a cousin who was an 82nd Airborne, and he came up to visit Jeff in Lejeune back when we were rifle company commanders. And I was hanging out with him that weekend, and we'd gone to the exchange and run into some of our Marines. And we'd both been company commanders for a while, so I mean we knew all our Marines, and of course we start fucking with them and joking and hassling them, and they were laughing. And this guy, his cousin goes, "Your Marines actually like you guys." And I'm like, "Of course they like us. What's not to like? We love them. What the hell?" It was and he could not get over the fact at how well we related to our Marines. And Jeff is much better at this than I am, and we're not typical in that respect, but we're not that unusual either, you know. And something that you did, Paul Kenny did, Duffy White, I could go on, naming guys who did the exact same thing, but that was not perceived as normal from other people from other branches.
No, well, even some Marines. I remember somebody who we taught with at IOC told me that, you know, when I first met you, I thought you were so unprofessional. I said, what?
I know who you're talking about. I'll bet you.
Yeah, he said, but now, after being around you for 2 years, I've seen how you use your personality to get to know people and then influence them, and that wasn't my style. And I just want to say I learned a lot from you. And I was like, because it's not like he told me one of these things and then a few months later he told me the whole thing at one time. And I didn't expect it. It came from, you know, literally blindsided me. Because we had professionally clashed in terms of, you know, ways to do different things and whatnot. And so it was very interesting. But you're right. It wasn't typical. You know, I used to hear the term troopendicular, which meant it skewed to, you know, the liking of young Marines. And you'd hear guys like us say, look, man, it's okay if it can be fun, right? There's no rule that says it can't be fun, right? So, I mean, so our training can be interesting and can be fun, and you can be a personality. And I will tell you what, the guy who really impacted me through all that was Zinni.
I was going to say that. I absolutely agree with you, because I think that my way of relating to Marines changed dramatically from before I went to Quantico, back as an instructor, and afterwards.
Well, and what he showed me was, and he would, you know, he and that personality, they were that was the way he was, and so he let it rip, and he was himself. And to me, I was like, wow, that guy. You know, and then I had, you know, other role models, you know, General Kelly, Major Kelly at the time. You know, he's very, you know, comfortable in his own skin, and he wasn't afraid. And I was like, oh, all right, well, I mean, I guess if you're going to do it, that's the way you should do it, and it'll take you wherever it takes you. And that is the truth. That is the truth. And so yeah. But what I think what those guys taught me was, the more you're yourself, the more you'll reveal to your Marines, the more access they will grant you to their lives, which ultimately means that you can have more influence over them. And that's why we do it, because the common denominator that we all have is we love Marines. I mean,
oh, yeah.
They are
oh, yeah.
That group of humans that, you know, they don't give a shit, man. If you tell them they can't do something, that's the first thing that's getting done. The thing right. that you just told them that they cannot do. And that's the corporate mentality. And so it's this wonderful group of funny, tough guys who will do anything if they believe in you. Absolutely anything. Hell, they'll do anything, most anything, if you just tell them to do it. If they believe in you, they will do anything. They will do anything. Oh, yeah. And I tell a funny story about all the different monuments that you see around the Marine Corps. And I asked Marines, I said, you know how those got here? And they just look at me like, we stole them. It's not like the mayor of some town gave us that shit. How did it get stolen? Well, a first sergeant or a company commander or battalion commander looked at something and said, you know, that'd look good in front of the CP when we get home. And then walked away. And then at 2:30 that morning, a sergeant with a truck with, you know, two corporals and three lance corporals and a PFC, they went out and they got that thing. And they threw it in the back of the truck and it got on the ship. And it got put out in front of the CP, and all of a sudden, somebody saw it and said, where the hell did that come from? I think you know, sir. How did it get here, sir? What would you get told, Timmy? Don't ask questions you don't need to know about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, you got to compartmentalize this kind of information.
So, the actually, speaking of that, there's a pretty interesting article in Stars and Stripes today about a study the Rand Corporation did on, they did it on overtasking of companies. And I would say it's a disease in the military because back in the day, they could tell you to do stuff and you say, yeah, I got it. And then you could report back, yeah, we've taken care of that. They had no way of watching you or quantifying it or looking at you. Or, hell, they couldn't even communicate with you other than the phone. Uh-huh. And now they can see into your shit. And they know. So you're running around with, you know, this task list from hell that you become a slave to. And so wow. it has to do with more, I can't gun deck stuff. I can't decide that's not really important to me. I'm not going to devote that much effort because they could see into your shit now.
See, I was not around when computers were that prevalent. And I remember that old PLAR system. Remember that position, yeah. location, reporting system, that gigantic, clunky thing we would go around? And I remember being terrified of it because all of us company grades, and I was at AWS at the time, all of us company grades were afraid we were going to get micromanaged from on high because recently the thing called email had come into being from the intranet, and there were guys getting taskers from colonels at 2 o'clock in the goddamn morning. And we're like, what the hell is this? Yeah. And so we looked upon this with very jaundiced eye, and I don't – of course, I was not in the service when all this was going down. I only was looking from the outside in. I remember being amazed at how much information – Dave Furness, when he was a colonel, could pull up, and how much you could pull up. It was amazing. But I didn't understand the ramifications because as a company commander, man, I pretty much did anything I wanted. I did not have a whole lot of mandates I had to answer to the colonel to.
Right. I had big, you know, you had big events on the TEEP.
Yeah.
That was it. And then to include inspections and things like that. The things that I hear. But again, what it requires, though, is, and I think our friends were like this, is you got to walk in and the first conversation is with the OPSO and say, hey, sir, look, I mean, I've got no space to do some of the things I need to do because I've got all this craziness on my teep. You've got to do something to insulate me. And then if you don't get the relief that you seek there, you're a commander, right? Those conversations go commander to commander, which is company commander to battalion commander. The OPSO's a staff guy. He ain't the CO. Now, you're going to piss him off when you do this, but that's life, and you can't be afraid to do it. And I think there's some people that, and again, we were part of an atypical group because the officers that go to where Tim and I met, the basic school and IOC, that's a pretty screened group. So the basic school, you compete to go there. And among a lot of officers who want to go back there and teach. And then to get to the infantry officer course was another competition among that group, that small group, who can go, who is good and who can go.
Right.
And so, anyway.
Yeah, you had to earn that. You know, I got over there pretty early because I would, when I was an SPC and Fox Company, I was doing Delta and Echo and everybody else's packages too, because you needed guys in the field to AI. That first time we met, I was AI'ing for you, I think. And that's how I got there, that and having a being a reader. But that was a very difficult thing to do.
Well, but again,
getting there was just, it was the best time of my life.
Right.
Without question.
But again, I don't know that very many people that were in that group would have a problem, would have a problem walking up to their OPSO and then their CO saying, I need help. Now, I would tell you, the average leader, you know, probably not like that.
I detected a difference from when I first was in the FMF in 87 and when I went back as a company commander. I guess that was 94 or so, 93, 94. And in 87, it was a hit or miss what kind of battalion you ended up in. I don't believe they screened or they selected the battalion commanders back then. And there were a lot of old Vietnam guys running around. And there were some old school S3 officers who were never going to get promoted, but they guarded their rice bowls jealously. But I ended up in 1-9, my first pump, not that functional a battalion, despite the fact that Bob Coates was in Bravo Company. We had some other long ball hitters. But the next time around, we had a guy named Dave Mize as a colonel. He came from Manpower, and he had handpicked. And we had great company commanders, Nicholson and Hummer being two of them. And man, when you're part of a good battalion, the battalion three, in our case, it was a guy named Mike Lowe who got out as a colonel, one of the funniest guys I've ever met. He could run with Paul Kennedy and Jeffro. He's so damn funny. But the tightness that you developed in that kind of an organization when everybody there is competent and the things we were allowed to do in training, it was night and day. Some of that, I believe, is a roll of the dice, because as a company commander, I had no problems going to my colonel and being very forthright about what I wanted to do or not do. And the three wasn't even, I'd been the three first because he kind of dicked me and made me the three, and then I got a company, but I didn't have any problems with the three. Whereas in my first time as a lieutenant, I don't think the company commanders could do anything without talking to the three, because he was a tough bastard.
All right,
he didn't do much, but he yelled a lot.
What do you got going between now and the new year? Anything exciting?
Not one damn thing exciting other than the football games. I've been steadily working away at the book. Put a couple posts up on the Free Range blog just to get that off my mind, for the exact same reason that I emailed you, by the way. I just had to get this shit off my mind so I could sleep. But I slept well last night, so I'm looking for a nice, restful weekend. And I will repair, my wife and I will repair to the range and do some pistol drills probably on Sunday. And that's about it.
All right. Well, first of all, I appreciate you hopping on and doing this. The end of the year is kind of I have a tradition of not doing too much serious. And I like to pull people on that have been guests during the year and kind of catch up with them and see what they're doing. So I appreciate you hopping on this morning. For those of you who, Jeff, he's flying today. So he was unavailable. So we'll hopefully catch up with him next week. But anyway, Timmy, Merry Christmas, and on the way to a new year, Happy New Year.
Yeah, Merry Christmas to you and your family, and thanks for having me on, Mac. I enjoyed this.
No, again, I hate the term thanks for sharing, but, you know, I appreciate, you know, your honesty. You know, I didn't know a lot of that stuff that you talked about today, and it's not the easiest stuff to talk about, but I think it inspires other people to not be afraid to go there in their life, and I think that's an important example, and it's an example worth setting. Most of
I appreciate that because I hate getting emotional. It really bothers me. But
why?
But it happens. Oh, because I think I'm a pussy. But
you know, I said that to somebody.
I don't think I'm a big enough asshole to start adding fuel to that fire. But in all honesty, it's a little bit embarrassing because I wish I could keep my composure better. But there's times I can't. And I now know that that's okay. I don't get excited about it anymore. Before, that would have bothered me for days.
I love that. I love that. I had somebody again, he asked me why. Mine are one of my daughters. Dad, why? I'm like, I'm still trying to prove I'm not a pussy. She says, aren't we over that yet? I said, no. No. No, we're not. She's like, oh, my God. You're hopeless. I said, possibly. I said, but I'm not a pussy. She said, no, you're stupid. I said, that's okay. I'll accept that. She's like, oh, my God. Anyway. All right, man. I appreciate the visit.
No worries, brother. You have a happy new year now.
All right. There you have it. Tim Lynch here on a post-Christmas version of All Marine Radio here on a Thursday. I've been struggling to say that it's Thursday, but in fact, it is Thursday. And that'll do it. So don't touch that dial. In the first hour, I'm going to tell you about the prime rib that I cooked last night, which turned out very well, I might add. And so, prime rib carrot casserole. Great combination. You can find both recipes on the All Marine Radio website. In fact, I followed the recipe to a T. Yeah, that's the one I use. Kim's, the chef's recipes. So, followed them to a T. And they worked. They worked. So, anyway, I'll be back tomorrow. He is supposed to join me, so I'm hopeful that he will. So don't touch that dial. Have a great day on a Thursday, All Marine Radio. Over and out. This is Mike McNamara. I don't know that I've ever done an interview like the one you just heard, and there's another 44 minutes coming up next. The following morning, I called Tim, and I said, what do I do with this stuff? Who knows about it? Does your family know? And he says, no, man, I've been up all night thinking about it. And so I said, he said, I need to give that thing some context. I said, well, come on this morning. Let's talk about it. So what you'll hear next is a follow-on conversation that we had the day after the first conversation, which was on Thursday the 26th, and the second conversation that you're about to hear is on Friday the 27th day of December in 2019. So, without further ado, Tim Lynch.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
This is an appropriate music for the intro music for the next segment. Joining me is Tim Lynch, who yesterday, like shocked me. And he says he told me this before, but I don't know if I had my head up my ass, so I thought he was just talking shit or whatnot. But Tim Lynch, good morning.
Hey, Mac, how are you?
I'm not good. Hold on.
I'm great.
Oh, no, no, no. It was me. It was me. It wasn't you. It was me. I didn't have the right things pulled. Yeah. What, okay, so yesterday, you started talking about being homeless, and I was stunned. And so I wanted to have you back on to give that interview some context.
Sure.
And so help us put that in context.
Okay. In my defense, which is no defense, I have slipped that in there a couple times in conversations before, and it hadn't been commented on, and I was perfectly happy to leave that sleeping dog lie. Now, I was a contractor for a number of years, and while I was contracting, I participated in a program that was an intelligence collection program that was run by a retired CIA guy from the side of his pool. I would talk to him on Skype. He'd be drinking wine and doing Claridge. And we were, I thought, quite effective, although I wasn't really too sure how kosher it was. At any rate, in 2010, March of 2010, a series of New York Times Above the Fold Sunday articles started out about this program. There are pictures of Dewey there and Mike Furlong, who I had met in Dubai prior to this thing starting up. Because I had been involved with the David Rhodes thing specifically to move money because I knew how to do that in Afghanistan. And I had given him my capabilities brief. You know, I had a guest house. I had secure comms via a DARPA-funded internet that was experimental, that wasn't connected to me. I had access and a reason to be places because I was in Reconstruction. I was working in both Jalalabad and Gardez. And so we started this thing up. Now, I don't really want to talk about that. I don't know how effective we are. That has yet to come out. The guys that wrote about it, Mark Marzetti, wrote a book in 2014 called The Way of the Knife, in which an entire chapter is dedicated to this. And in all these things, I'm described as a commercial Jason Bourne. This was used against me in divorce court to paint me as basically a contract killer. My defense, because I couldn't afford a lawyer, my lawyer had tapped out of money long before. My defense was there's no such thing as that. The American government doesn't do that stuff. But I really couldn't account. I didn't have much else to say about that. That resulted in a $250,000 judgment against me. I surrendered my passport to the divorce court. I had an IRS tab. When all the investigations were done, the entire ops fund was given to me as a 1099 because I couldn't account for it any other way. The IRS thought I owed them $700,000. And I was in not a great place. So I was in a house that was obviously I could stay in until my bankruptcy went through, my no asset bankruptcy. And, you know, I started liquidating assets. I donated, I think, 300 books to University of Oregon. Broke my heart to the Tarazi there. And I started planning what I was going to do next because I earned money. I didn't think that was going to happen. And so I come across the idea I'm going to walk across the country because it sounded better than being homeless. Because as soon as the divorce court, as soon as that's finalized, if the truck goes, the house goes, I got to go. And I started working at a walk-in. And I was in great duress. And I was way too embarrassed to tell anybody. And because I knew this was coming. I stayed in Afghanistan for 7 years to avoid exactly what I knew was coming. And I didn't protect myself at all because I was an idiot. I, quite frankly, never thought I'd come back from Afghanistan. As part of that program, I took not inconsiderable risks, but be that as it may, and I felt bitter that that what I get in return is written about in the paper as if we're a bunch of bozos and clowns. That portrayal changed in the book, by the way, by Mazzetti. And I think it's going to change more when another book comes out. I don't know. But I know what we were doing. But at any rate, I was bitter and I was angry and I couldn't really tell anybody this. Nobody believed what the hell I had to tell them. I got arrested inside of Pakistan and accused of being a spy in the Northwest frontier. And you know, I tell you that and you're like, whoa, right? But here's the thing. I had taken a guy because Dewey told me I had to up to Peshawar, right? And I knew that I had to stay overnight and get a tribal pass and get an escort to come back. I knew that, but I tried to sneak back because I thought I was slick. And I got busted in Landy Hotel. And I got hauled back up there, and I had to cough up some money and call for reinforcements to come stay with me because I was by myself in Peshawar. Not cool, right? But it was my fault. I did that to myself because I'm an idiot. So I just did an example. So I'm bitter about all this kind of stuff. And I can't sleep. I can't. I get popped for a DUI. I stop drinking. I can't drive my truck now because I can't afford a breathalyzer thing. But the cop is most sympathetic. I wasn't that far over, but I was over, you know. So I stopped drinking entirely. I figured, okay, this is an existential crisis. And what can I do? I can walk across the country. I'll write a book when I get done. It'd be fascinating. This would be great.
Why didn't you go get a job?
Oh, in coastal Oregon, for one, anything I made would have been taken from me outside of my retirement pay. And for two, there's no work in coastal Oregon. I did try to get a job. But I at the time, given my amount of debt I had, I didn't feel it was to my advantage to get a job. And the only thing I could really do would be go back overseas, but I didn't have a passport. So that was out of the question. I was like, no, I'm not going to get a job. I'm not, no. But I lied to everybody. I mean, I lied to my dad. And I said I had a contract based on my blog to walk across the country. Total lie. And I started, and if you had seen me at the time, I would have never told you what was going on. I would have told you, yeah, dude, I got a contract. I'm walking across the country, man. I know. This is awesome, isn't it? And I thought I was great. I was losing weight. I could hump in the rain for 10 hours straight, set up my tent and get in a baby sack and get relatively dry by the morning and sleep like a baby. I thought it was great. I could eat anything I wanted. I was constantly eating junk
food. Okay, hold on. So you thought it was great, but you know it's not. So you're living in like two worlds. Bizarro world and the other world where you're, I don't know what you would call it, running from your problems, where you created this, you segmented your life. And again, a lot of people do it, you know, because we don't want to, what would you say, too proud? Too proud to bed?
I was way too proud. I was humiliated, Mac. Right. I mean, fuck, dude. You know, we weren't bad infantry officers, you know. We had potential. And where was I now? In debt I could never dream of getting out of. And I wasn't working actively to do that. And I thought, if you had asked me, man, if you had told me you looked like shit, which my daughter did when she saw me, I would have told you, no, dude, I can walk 20 miles a day. I'm not drinking. So I don't even know what your problem is. I'm not drinking. And to me, that meant I had no problems. I had a plan, and I was working towards it. And I got proud about being able to suck up the cold wet. But I got tired of walking because I started talking to myself. And I wouldn't stop when I was around people. And so I'm like, fuck, I'm going to ride a bike. Because if I rode a bike, I wouldn't be talking to myself so much. You know, I'd have something to do. And so I got a bike. I saved up, and I was pounding up and down. Actually, I was pounding down the coast and take a bus up the coast because I couldn't ride into the wind. It's too hard. And I thought I was doing great. And once that thing
but
all
you
cleared,
know, but, you know, but you know you're not, right? You're faking like you're doing great. And you have the facade of doing great, but do you know you're not?
Yeah. Well, I was reading the Stoics and whatnot. I didn't cry, and I didn't drink. I'm like, nah, dude. I can do this.
So you're selling. You're selling yourself on the false narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. And buying it. Now here's the punchline. So my daughter comes up to see me. She calls a buddy of mine in Corpus, Keith Rose, who's a doctor. And actually, I'd known him in Afghanistan. So he sells me on this job and thing, and I call up USAA because I hadn't surrendered my vehicle yet. I said, hey, do you want to collect my vehicle in Texas instead of Oregon? They said, yeah, we prefer that. So I drove down there and surrendered my vehicle, got a bike. I still had a bike, you know, and I got a job at a vegetable warehouse. And Keith looked at me. And he says, you look like shit. I had no idea what he's talking about. So then he gives me a physical. Blood sugars 410, blood pressure 190 over 140. I had pericarditis. I was no shit malnourished. Because I couldn't keep the calories in. I was burning them too fast. And I thought I was great. And people who see me today, that saw me back then, are like, holy shit, you look great. I'm like, what are you talking about? I always looked like this. But I didn't see it. I had no clue. None. I thought I was great because I wasn't drinking.
So what changes all of that? So you have this, you have this deluded narrative that you're trying to sell them to yourself, knowing all the while that you're running from it. Why did it ever cross your mind to stop faking it, or was the fact that, you know, we have our friends are war heroes and guys who do great things, so I'm not going to be that guy in that group? What drives the isolation?
Good news, bad news here. Okay, I come back. I recognize that I'm not doing well. I used to do the morning radio show every once in a while with Jim Longo. He's retired now, Texas Hall of Famer, and he told me he's a Vietnam vet and who had had significant problems until he was drinking and whatnot, until he sobered up. And so he had told me I wasn't doing good. I went to the vet center, and some prick of a sergeant major there said, "You're a contractor. You got contractor issues. We're not for you. We're for veterans. Retired officers got their own goddamn health care." Boom. Right?
Whoa.
So there was my first attempt to seek help from a vet center. But a week later, I was so distraught that I wasn't sleeping. And I wasn't feeling so hot. I wasn't walking. I wasn't doing shit. And I went to the VA. And a therapist there named Martin, I don't know if I should say his last name, he saw me sitting way back in the thing, and he told him, "Get him back here to me right now." And he looked at me, and he's like, "What the fuck is going on?" And I'm like, "Dude, I got problems. I don't know where to start." And that's where I stopped. That's where I turned around.
Just that conversation with him?
No, I had to go. I went every other day for a week. He tried to make me take pills, and pills were part of my problem. I don't know if you ever heard of a combat cocktail, but it's 200 milligrams of Ambien, 5 milligrams of Valium, 10 of Lisinopril, a blood pressure decompressor. What it's designed to do, I'll tell you what it's excellent at, is when you take it, within a half hour, you empty out your lower colon. So that's awesome. You're not going to have to piss or take a crap the rest of the day if you watch your water. But it's designed to even you out if you get into a bad bind. You get that big adrenaline spike. It's supposed to chemically even that out and keep your blood pressure down below 140, 150. That's the idea. I don't know. I wasn't paid to be driving into ambushes. Some people were, in some of those contractors, the guys doing the mail runs, they got in dust-ups all the time, and they're the ones that started this. But I got used to taking it because it made me feel good. And so I wouldn't take any pills. I wasn't drinking. I wouldn't take any pills. I just gutted it out. And Martin said, okay. And he worked with me to the point that I recognized that I needed help, and I needed to start behavioral therapy, start reprogramming my thinking about what's good and what's not good and what's self-destructive and what's not self-destructive. Because I wasn't drinking, so I wasn't self-destructive. All you had to do was ask me. I knew it all.
Wow.
Fucking crazy.
So let me ask you this. So you lived that, bizarro world that you created for yourself, that you defined for yourself, which allowed you to be highly functioning in bizarro world.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't.
But you're constantly nagged by that whole reality thing when sometimes that curtain gets moved a little bit. So what do you tell people now in light of your experience? Again, because, you know, the first commandment of post-traumatic winning, adopted within the last 60 days because I've seen the power of, is stop faking it. Stop fucking faking.
You think
like
I
you're
said
okay.
This shit on that veterans retreat last September? Fuck no. I did not.
You did not?
I did not.
Holy shit.
I don't think I've ever told anybody. So I'm still faking it, bro. I got to tell you, I've worked with some guys.
Hey, the only thing that's going to happen is that you're gonna help people and save people. That's the only thing that's going to happen.
I have helped people on this, on one of these Facebook pages, these veteran Facebook pages, where I see people post this, I can't go on. I've communicated with him and offered to walk with him. I call it walking it off. I'm said, and I tell him, dude, you got to reduce your problems to getting warm and getting enough food in your belly, and you do that shit by humping and putting yourself out there. Because there's stretches of the Oregon coast where, you know, your hypothermia sets in, you're kind of screwed. And so you got to know what you, so it takes a competency just to do that. It's not like you can just throw a bunch of shit in your pack and wander off. You know, you got to plan that shit out and think it through. And so I've helped people that way, but I've never told anybody the full extent of my problems. I mean, for one thing, who the fuck's going to believe it? I mean, it's sort of bullshit I did, but I a book will be out about that, and we'll see what the history has to say about it. I don't know.
So
it was a fascinating story.
So what advice do you give people?
Oh, seek help. Listen to All Marine Radio. I got the 10 rules two commandments on my cell phone. I do that shit constantly.
Three goals, 10 commandments. Get it fucking right.
Yeah, there you go.
If you're going to be a disciple, don't be fucking it up.
Well, I've got the newest one. I think talking with you and Jeff has, well, my wife will tell you, it's been a tremendous help to me, because I don't know a lot of people down here, and I'm, I don't think if you looked at me today, you would suspect that, you know, what's it, 6 years ago, that this is my situation, but, and I don't like admitting it myself. It's fucking embarrassing, bro. But it's true, and I know it can help now, and I never understood that until you started coming along with this a PTW. I have to be sincere. That's why I've always been such a disciple.
I was always found it curious why you were so enthusiastic about post-traumatic wing.
Yeah, no, it's helped me out tremendously, but I still didn't want to. I didn't want to talk about this. I kind of stumbled into it yesterday. I was hoping that we'd kind of gloss over it like it has in the past. But I think that email guy, somebody got me on the email, and I had to explain. And I was mortified when I hung up. I didn't want to do that.
Do you feel good or bad about it, right?
I feel better. But, I didn't sleep well last night, you know. I've been pacing about. I've been writing more. Because I indirectly wrote about this, I've been posting about this. I wrote a blog post I put up on Christmas Eve, the sheepdog stuff, which started from a conversation we had, you, me, and Jeff, and because I knew the history behind it, because we knew Grossman before he became a thing, and the sheepdog thing's so big. And I included this whole, not the confession part, but about being out of shape and getting back in shape, and because what happened after the physical is I got put on the testosterone and human growth hormone and I started taking supplements and the difference physically has been phenomenal. And I've bitched at you about that too. I think you should get on it. But I kind of related that in a post, and I was thinking about all this, up until I'm sitting here talking with you about it, I would have told you, oh, fuck, I was an awesome homeless guy. You shitting me? I was the friggin' best.
Now, when you say homeless, what does that mean?
Homeless meant to me, I never was truly homeless. I had a place to go back to. I had a truck that I had to surrender. By the time I surrendered the truck and I was truly homeless, I wasn't that homeless because I was staying in my buddy's, I call it his shed. He had built a little bunkhouse behind his house. It's right on the bay. It was nice. But I'm living in a garden shed, essentially. I mean, it doesn't have a toilet or nothing. But it was nice. It had air conditioning. And I'm riding my bike, and I'm getting menial work. And so I call my homeless period the time that I was, an entire year that I was stuck in place. And I didn't have to be. In my mind, I was stuck in place. And I was preparing myself to walk across the country because after I was evicted, that was it. I had nothing. And it was an intensely humiliating and embarrassing situation to be in.
So if you were to counsel people who have friends that are homeless, or maybe somebody homeless is going to listen to this interview, what do you tell them?
Oh, they've got to reach out to somebody. Do you know, You know, I started getting my confidence back when I finally got that job at that trucking company. I had no idea what I was going to do, but I become the safety guy, and safety is a big deal because it's federally tracked, and it's scored every quarter. And if your safety scores drop, you're not going to work on oil rig, jobs. They won't take you unless your safety record's high. We were having problems. I take over, and I look, and I say, this is easy. All we got to do is take the safety classes to the guys because, I mean, all our drivers are lining up on some of these frack jobs. I'll go out there at 2 o'clock in the morning. We'll sit there and bullshit. We'll do it. And our safety stats went sky high because all the drivers wanted was somebody that cared about them. They didn't like calling on Saturday getting bitched at by the old guy. He was screaming about numbers. I just would go out there and friggin' talk to him and shoot the shit. Classic E-Tour stuff, right?
Well, no. It's the way you do it. If you want... my sons and I were talking about this here recently. You know, you say that we're going to have 25% alert tonight, right? Well, look, if nobody goes and checks it, you're going to have zero alert, okay? And so who checks it? Do the squad leaders check it? Or should it be a combination of the platoon sergeant, the platoon commander, the guide, and the squad leaders? They got to take their turn like everybody else. Leadership by example. And so that's what you're talking about.
But if I called Mike Etor and said, hey, Mike, I am in a hell of a pickle here, and I need some help. Do you think maybe? Because it wasn't like I had capabilities. I got a very negative self-image because I had navigated myself into the situation, and I hated myself for it. I was so full of self-loathing. It was ridiculous. But I was capable. I mean, I knew what I knew what my DNA was. If I had called you, or if I had called Etor, if I had called, I could think of guys off Drew Watson out at Mark Houck, my old company commander, shit, my old battalion commanders, J.C. Hardy. If I had called those guys, you think maybe somebody would have figured out something to do besides walk 20-25 miles on Christmas Day?
Well, yeah, they would have. Well, the first thing they would have done is they would have talked to you, right?
Yeah,
and would establish. Reestablished in some cases, but, you know, expanded on that connection that you had. And then they would have heard your story, and then they would have thought about it, and then at some point they would have said, hey, man, this is bullshit. Which is what you needed, right?
Yeah. I was trying to handle it my own. The intractable tax problems were actually resolved when I asked for help from this guy was excellent. He was a medicinal pot growing guy, right? But he was also a CPA. Hated the IRS. He redid my taxes in pencil and wrote out an explanation in pencil. Because I never worked for the company that gave me the 1099. I had no employment records of mine. And I got an IRS lady called me and they ate it. They said, great. What about 2011 taxes? I'm saying, oh, well, 30 is better than 100,000.
Right.
So I'm still paying on that. So I resolved that issue because that issue was horseshit. But other than that, I mean, I was crippled, and I thought I was a failure. And the only thing I had to keep me going was I wasn't drinking, and I could hump a load, bro. I could move out on the damn pavement, which I thought was cool.
So at the center of it is what? I'm a failure, and none of the rest of my friends are failure.
Oh yeah.
That's at the center of it.
Instructor who's homeless. I guarantee you, I'm the first. Maybe, hopefully, the last. Inshallah.
I don't know that that's true, man.
That's true. I don't know either. But I am with it. I don't know now because I've got a little bit more aware. But I was so insulated. I was not receiving information. I was pleasant. Estate cops, they got used to me. They'd stop every once in a while and bullshit with me. I thought I was fucking doing great. They thought I was going to go across the country and whatnot. They thought it was cool. Because, you know, you can't be walking along 101 at night.
That was all the facade to camouflage the homeless.
Oh, yeah. I thought I had everybody fooled. Didn't fool my daughter for a second. But everybody else did. And I was in such poor physical health. It's a wonder. You know, it's just a wonder that I didn't hurt myself badly, you know. Yeah, it's just I cannot believe it. But I pulled myself out. I needed the help. I finally got effective counseling. And it wasn't until I ran into Martin, who again, I mean, if I had
waited, Martin just comes out and sees you in a waiting room.
Yeah.
And looks and at you to, and said, "You were that fucked. You were that fucked up."
Yeah. He goes, "Get him back here right now." You see, I saw him look at me. I saw him talking to somebody. They looked at me. The next thing you know, he comes up, and goes, "Hey, sir, they want to see you right now." And I hadn't been sitting there 2 minutes. You know, I don't know what I looked like, but I didn't look good.
No, you and, think a fucking yeah. complete stranger looks at you and says, "Get his ass back here." Yeah.
Oh, he was a great guy too. I mean, he really, really helped. And although I refused taking any pills,
have you ever reached out to him and told him?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. He transferred up to Dallas. We keep in touch every once in a while.
Awesome. All right, so let me ask you this: in all this, right now that you've added some context to it, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you want people to know? Where do you hope this goes?
If you've got a friend and you see this guy or gal and you can tell shit is not right, you've got to probe. If your intuition is telling you this guy is in trouble and he's telling you, "Hey, fuck you, I don't drink, I can walk farther than you can," you've got to probe. Because I would have deflected you for hours, dude. There's no way I would have admitted.
No, you know what, Timmy? Let me just tell you. The reason you didn't tell us is because we don't play that game. Right?
Oh, yeah. No, I know.
We would have called bullshit on you so fast.
Yeah, I know. I know exactly why. I know I wouldn't have fooled you guys for a second. But I would have deflected forever. I was never going to call. Not until I started listening to you as you put together this post-traumatic winning thing. And I got it because I had listened to most of those interviews that you did when you first put it together. And I was so thankful because although I still don't connect enough, I'm still isolated. I went to that veterans retreat. I didn't say shit. A little bit to one guy, maybe. And it wasn't even a guy that was at the retreat. It was a guy at the skydiving place, a force recon, a retired officer. I talked to him a bit, and I'd send him some emails. That's the only guy I told. And so I'm not, I am a disciple, but I don't think up until us having this conversation.
You're a closet disciple. But, you know, there's a lot of people like that. A lot of people, that's why I say, and that's why one of the most interesting things and the comment I get the most when I do post-traumatic winning is it felt like you were talking straight to me.
Oh, yeah.
And the response always is, "I was, motherfucker. I was talking straight to you." Right? If it resonated like that, this is the wisdom of our tribe talking to you, and I'm simply the courier. Okay, so now the last piece of this is the chef's trying to call me. He's driving me nuts. How did you meet your wife? She must be a saint, for God's sakes. Hello?
Hello?
Oh, fuck. Hold on. Wait. The chef's fucking me up, man. God almighty. Fucking stop already. I sent him a text. I'll call you in 5 minutes. So, explain meeting your second wife.
Oh, well, I eventually, once I had found a good place to live and I bought an acceptable-looking vehicle, I started internet dating. This is something that Martin kind of introduced me to. And I was relatively successful because I didn't have any pictures of me with dead fish on my profile.
There you go.
Separated me from everybody else, it seemed. And I went out on a few dates. I felt like I was relatively normal. I didn't say shit about anything. And that's how I met Rebecca. And I knew from the first time we went out that I was most interested in her. And then we started dating exclusively. And then then I came down here because it, as well as I was doing at Ainsworth Trucking, the bottom fell out of the oil industry there a couple years
ago. Right,
and he was hurt. And so he had to downsize. And I said, you know, boss, I'm going to go leave and go down to with my girl in McAllen. And if you guys start cranking back up again, I'll do pusher work out in McAllen, cover the south for you. But I said I'm going to go do something else. And he said, that's fine. And so I've been down here. I've been writing rather productively, and I'm not under any strain to go necessarily and do anything. So I constructively fill my day, and I'm enjoying the hell out of it. I'm much calmer now and more centered and focused. I feel more like myself. And participating on All Marine Radio has a lot to do with that, because I think of stuff I've forgotten that I wasn't always a fuck up.
So Rebecca. She's a keeper. All right. So is there anything?
That's the first thing Paul Kennedy said when he met her.
Yeah.
Timmy, if you fuck this one up, I'm going to be pissed at you.
And she's from McAllen. That's how you got there.
She's down here. She's an educator. She's a university vice president. So that's her thing. Yeah, she got the PhD.
Wow.
Got in organizational leadership, and man, is she impressed by Mike Etor. Holy smokes, dude.
Mike's got it.
She's off. She loves the Marine Corps, but the only exposure she had was at Mel's retirement, you know, so she met, Jennifer Ness and Kennedy and Nicholson and a bunch of those guys, and she was so impressed. She's like, I should have been a Marines all my life. And I said, this is a little different.
Yeah, this is not the good cross section. Okay.
Yeah.
If you met the rest of the bell curve, you might not say that.
Oh yeah, no, but yeah, Mellinger, what a class act. So her impression of the Marine Corps is based exclusively on that. And you and Mike Etor. So
she needs to spend a little bit more time. But I mean, it's a fun group, no doubt. It's a fun group, no doubt. Let's see. How do we conclude this? What else do you want to say that I haven't asked you? Anything?
I would say to tend to people you know don't have family there over the holidays. What I originally started, the way we got down this road was my relating to you how much I dreaded Thanksgiving and Christmas during that time frame. And I had spent a lot of them overseas, and they were never very pleasant over there either. And so I would say you've got to tend to the flock, if you will, your friends who you know are probably isolated, and pay attention to them. And again, if there's something that doesn't sound right, you're going to have to probe, because some of us are stubborn. And I'm not going to freaking cough that shit up unless I'm forced to, which generally is going to require face to face.
All right. Well, there you have it. The context, the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say, after a pretty interesting interview yesterday. So, all right, Timmy, I will package this all together and think of a headline, and we'll put it out there. So, I commend you for your honesty. Like, and again, what I want to do is just, you're no different from anybody else. And the power of your story, will change people's lives. Right, I told you. I mean, I haven't even put up on the internet. I got an email about it last night. Here's another one. Jesus H. Christ, best interview ever. Thank you. And again, it's just so important that we stop faking it, right? Because, I mean, how fast could you have solved your problems had you just been humble enough to go to people and say, I'm struggling. I don't know what to do. Could you help me?
Yeah, weeks at the most. Because I had no clue. I had no fucking clue what to do.
Right. And so, right. So the moral of the story is, when in doubt, tell the truth, right? Rely on the people who love you, and you'll get wherever you're going faster and stronger. Right, because the whole playing charades is bullshit.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And, and now I'm on this big health kick because I'm post-60. I'm in better shape now than I've ever been, now that I've gotten my medical problems solved. I'm a big acolyte. I wrote a post directed at you, by the way, mister. That's that last post.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate you coming back on today. And I appreciate your honesty. Much love to you, and even more love to Rebecca, who must be a fucking saint. And Happy New Year, man.
Happy New Year to you too. And thanks, Mac. I would have never told this story if it hadn't been for what you've been doing. I mean that sincerely. That's why I've always been such an accolade.
Let me read another one. Wow! ! Hey, Mac, that's quite a story with Tim. He is way too common of many guys. I know, especially cops, firefighters, etc., that don't talk and discuss issues. It's so common we bury them and cannot be humble and ask for help. Thanks, Tim! ! Big Dave in Vacaville.
Well, I appreciate that, man. I really do.
No, I mean it's just
not easy.
And I read you a text message that I got last night. And I'll read you the messages that I got, that I read to Tim. I won't tell you who sent them, but somebody listened to the interview. And
who knows this stuff?
Right? The first one is this. I'm in the middle of it. Dude, this is insane. Next one. This is awesome. Next text message is, fuck, and it's Tim Lynch. Like, I don't know, you're on Mount Rushmore or something, right? And then the next one, did that chick take all his shit and run off? And I thought, and then my response is, who fucking knows? I was too stunned to ask. And then, he told me this morning I was a shitty interviewer. Exactly. And so that's why I said I got to get Tim on, because I know I was a shitty interviewer, because let me just tell you, the truth is so fucking powerful. You know, and I've seen it. You know, I mean, you know, again, next week it'll be a year that I was at Camp Lejeune. And Matt Kiker, who I crossed paths with, and I remember he looked at me that day, and he's crying, tears coming down his face, he's shaking because of his drinking. And he looks at me and he said, does it ever stop hurting? And I said, no, man, it never does, ever. And he said, and now, you know, almost a year later, what he says is, I knew you weren't lying to me. And that's what I knew, I could believe you. And that's the importance of the truth. And just like Dave says, that's why I'm so excited to go do this with the Clark County Firefighters, which is Las Vegas. Because they do the same shit, man, and we can be a role model.
Tell Kiker and those other guys to include the Navy Cross guy. Who's that staff sergeant?
Workman.
Yeah, staff sergeant Workman. You can tell them that their stories had a lot to do with me being able to just suddenly start talking about this shit yesterday, because it was not my intention to.
Right.
I'm not really too sure why I did. And I wasn't too happy about it yesterday evening, but I thought it was worth doing, and now I know it was completely worth doing, and I appreciate people's positive feedback, because
but again, the thing is, and we all think we're all exceptional. We're all exceptional, but
I'm
we're not.
An exceptional homeless guy.
No, but we're all struggling with this shit in our lives, and like you said, look, I mean, it would have probably taken you a few months with the help of the people that love you to get on the right track again. But that thing went for a long time, and it didn't have to.
Four years till I got back on track and was working to my capacity. Wow. 4 friggin' years. Wow.
And you know what, Timmy? And here's that's a good news story, right? The bad news story, there's a lot of people that don't make it through those 4 years.
Oh, no, I know that. Believe me, the whole time I was going through them, I thought, hey, I'm doing great. I'm not drinking. Fuck.
Did you ever think of killing yourself?
No. Once. I did when I wrote a post that kind of announced that I think I had PTSD on my blog. It was the most popular post in my blog. It went viral. I deleted it shortly thereafter. I was humiliated that I put it. But what it spurred me was the thought that, dude, you know, I had a flash in my head that it sounded reasonable to cap myself. And I'd come back. I kind of was fucked up. I had broken ribs and shit when I came back. But I went running. And I ran for 3 miles. Or ran or walked. And I went back and I read that, wrote that post. I stopped drinking for the first time, and started running. And I just missed the call from Dave Furness. I started running, and that was.
Hey, yeah. He's gonna yell at you. He's gonna be like, dude, what? Expect to get this reaction from your friends. Are you fucking kidding me? Like, no, what the fuck?
And look, I'm gonna defend myself. If I was in the same situation now, I would reverse my decision. But back then, there's not a fucking chance in hell I want anybody to find out about this. I was goddamn embarrassed, and it was my fault. Nobody to blame but me.
All right.
Nobody.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, very proud of you, Tim. And let me just tell you, just keep telling that story and don't be afraid of it, man. It is what it is. And anybody who judges you, you know, there's a short message for them. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Right? You know?
Oh, yeah, I'm good with that one. I'm good.
Yeah, no, I'm awesome with that one. So anyway. Yeah. All right, man. Thank you.
All right, brother.
See you.
You bet. I got to go talk to Dowie.
Bye.
I'll talk to you later. Right. Thank you.
There you have it. Tim Lynch. Yeah. Unbelievable. More Ballmer Radio. Again, reach out to the people that are telling you they're not struggling, but you think they might be, because you just never know. All right? You just never know. So we'll take a quick break. We'll get the chef on. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.